During these times, you gotta allow for some, like, you know, leniency.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Because shit is wild now.
It's true. Yeah, I just had a call an hour and a half ago when someone actually said he was going to be in the weeds, boots on the ground. I'm like, what does that even mean? Are we just like getting next level corporate here? Or have you also lost your mind during the pandemic?
It sounds like he's doing like some weekend warrior type of activity out in the meeting.
What is Black Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast where we break down what it means to be a Black creative in an attempt to defy the myth of a Black monolith and have dope conversations with each other in the process. For more info on how to listen or how to support the continuation of this series, visit whatisblackpodcast.com for links to podcast services and our donations page. As of this recording, I have read and finished today's guest's book, Black Card, and I can say unequivocally that it was a delight and I highly recommend it. My only gripe is that I didn't write it because it's really insightful and really well done. Well done, Mr. Terry. Well done. It got me thinking about the magical Negro trope and how it's wasted on white people. A magical Negro, for those unfamiliar, is a plot device that provides insight, enlightenment, or quote-unquote fixes to a white lead character only to progress the white lead's story arc, without actually developing a story of their own. Their existence serves to make the white lead a better white lead and show that the world is a great place, racism is dead, blah blah blah. See Will Smith's early movie career, most of Morgan Freeman's catalog, or Terry Crews / Van Jones in real life for details. Black people need to be Black people's magical Negroes. White people don't need the help. They'll be fine. I would love for a supernatural Black fairy to come save me, teach me how to be a better person, play video games with me, and fix my life. I want an Ayanla with superpowers, an Obama that's an X-Man. Or maybe I just need to do some shrooms and look in the mirror. I can probably be my own magical Negro.
What's up, everybody? I'm Jason McCoy, aka your auntie's little boyfriend, which is kind of weird and problematic, but we won't get into that right now. And today we're sitting here with novelist Chris L. Terry. What's up, Chris?
Hey, Jason, how you doing?
I'm good, and you?
Good, good. Excited to be here.
Yeah, how's life?
Oh, my neighbors are excited too. What is this? Man, I'm good. It's it is a 58-year-old that still rocks the Michael Jordan gold hoop earring, riding their motorcycle around, listening to like Quiet Storm type of shit. Wow. Season in my neighborhood right now. Yeah, I don't know what it is.
So you got like a bunch of
big motorcycles.
A bunch of unicorns just like in your neighborhood.
Yes.
Black unicorns or whatever.
I was at the park with my kid the other day, and one guy was just circling it, listening to Basketball by Curtis Blow, like riding a Harley.
Oh,
like,
they're playing basket. That song?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like his high school hit that he was still cranking.
I feel like that's
double
rainbow and unicorn.
Yeah. Hmm. So that's how I'm doing today. I'm doing good. I'm playing basketball.
Cool. I mean, if any sport to play in this heat, basketball is a good one. Unless it's like table tennis when you're indoors in AC.
Mm-mm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your work?
Sure. I'm a novelist. My most recent book is called Black Card. White people usually think it's about a credit card. Black people know otherwise. It's a satirical fictional novel about a mixed race punk rock musician who goes on a mission to win back his black card. Like he has an actual physical black card, a symbol of his credibility as a black person. And in the process, he gets accused of a violent crime that makes him kind of reconsider the way that the world sees him. Adds some nuance to his ideas of blackness and makes him reconsider his relationship with his imaginary friend, his black imaginary friend, Lucius. It's set in Richmond, Virginia, kind of in the shadows of the Confederate monuments that are coming down now.
Mm. Yeah. I like that. Like, it has like, it seems to have like a kind of like sci-fi overtones or undertones, whichever tones, but definitely sci-fi tones
to it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the world is weird and hard to live in, so I think, you know, you got to use your imagination to escape it.
Cool. So before we, like, get any deeper, there's an important question that I like to ask. I ask all my guests, and, like, it's usually something that's very personal to me. Is Johnny Rotten the punkest motherfucker alive because of or in spite of his support of Donald Trump? Or has his punk card been revoked?
I think he was just a troll before there was a troll. And that, like, some of those kind of original 1970s white punks were, like, we're kind of doing edgelord behavior, you know? It's a lot of the same type of trollish stuff. It was, like, almost prototypical alt-right. You know, you saw that in some of the rock and roll of the era where they were using Nazi imagery for shock value and stuff. The Sex Pistols got some songs, but as far as I'm concerned, Johnny Rotten's always been a clown. And he'd probably tell you the same, honestly. That's about where I'm at. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting because it's just like, I won't go as far as to say I'm a fan of the Sex Pistols, but I definitely listen to some of their music. And like, so I never knew exactly where Johnny Rotten stood on the spectrum of anything, because that dude was just all over the place. I just knew I kind of liked him.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, there is something appealing about anyone who's like, okay, if this is, I'm going to go against whatever everyone else is saying. I'm not going to think like you. But, right. You know, you can kind of paint yourself into a corner doing that shit pretty quickly.
Very true.
Yeah.
So do you think, would you say like Kanye, do you think like Kanye's the new Johnny Rotten or no?
I don't know. I can't believe that Kanye died in 2013 and like, we're never going to know if Yeezus was finished or like what he would have had to say about Trump, you know, because he really gave it to George W. Bush about Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
So I feel like he would have had something to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a shame that he's been gone for what, 7 years now, because he's missed.
Rest in peace. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Kanye. Yeah.
Maybe if he would have graduated from college, he could have been something instead of dropping out.
Yeah.
So in your experience, you talk about punk, and your book has a lot of like punk rock, I want to say influences because I haven't actually read it, but like, if you know, would you say it does have a lot of influences?
Oh yeah, so it's set in the punk scene in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay.
And you know, it's like, you know, a lot of basement shows, you know, playing to 20-30 people, bands going on tours and vans that break down a lot, making $20 a night, sleeping on people's floors, working a food service job and taking time off to go on tour. Just the kind of like low level, like do it yourself, DIY, punk rock community, which has this kind of, you know, kind of a tight knit feeling, but was also, especially at the time, like a very white space, even though it had a lot of gestures toward being progressive.
Right. Yeah. So that's what leads me to my first question is, in your experience, where do you see black people fitting in the spectrum of punk rock or punk as a movement?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's, you know, there's always been black people in the mix. Some of those original 70s groups like Polystyrene, the singer for the X-Ray Specs, is a black woman. Bad Brains from DC was an all black group and probably the first hardcore band. You know, we've always been in there, but it's been a primarily white space, even if we were kind of innovating within it. James Spooner made a documentary in the early 2000s called Afropunk, which really spoke to those experiences really, really well. And I think that a community kind of sprung up around that, because that's right when social media was kicking off too. So black punks had an easier time finding each other. And I think there are just more black people, people of color, and like women, queer people. It isn't just a straight white boys club. Punk isn't like it used to be, even in my heyday, which was 20 years ago. You know, I think in the last 10 years even, it's really changed. So that's where I think black people fit in.
Mm. And so is there, like with Afropunk, do you think that there's necessarily a difference, or how does black punk, Afropunk differ from straight, no adjective punk?
Sure. Well, one of my favorite groups, like current black punk band, is called Soul Glow, like a reference to Coming to America. And they really, it's kind of chaotic, screamy, hardcore punk music. So some of the more abrasive type of stuff. But then they also weave in hip hop in a really original way, I think. You know, sometimes you get some, I interviewed them a couple months ago, and we were talking about how they weave hip hop into their rock music without making like Limp Bizkit rap rock.
Yeah, you know, metal type. Yeah.
Yeah, like they do it without being corny. It sort of, it goes from this like screaming hardcore to kind of a abrasive, noisy hip hop that you could hear like Danny Brown rapping over or something like that, like more alternative stuff. So it's cool to see some of those influences coming in what feels like a really organic way. You know, their bass player does like beats and bass.
Oh, so he's like smacking it and like making a beat with it.
No, he programs. He uses, Ableton or one of those. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So you could just straight up rap over one of the songs and forget you're hearing a punk band. But it still sounds kind of punk. It has that energy.
Right.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite groups now, Horror of 1999, like I just love them to death. And like, I like how they blend like hip hop and punk, because it's just like, definitely, I would say it's definitely more punk than hip hop, but when it drops, it has that same like guttural feel of just street hip hop, just like bob your head and just like fuck yes.
Yeah, is Vic Mensa in that group?
No, he did. Did Vic Mensa do a song with them? I can't remember if Vic Mensa did a song with them, but I believe there's definitely some overlap, because like when they tour, like I know Vic Mensa's got a. It's okay. I mean, I don't know if you're a Vic Mensa fan or if you know Vic Mensa, but it's his like non hip hop stuff is not that good to me.
Okay. Yeah. I kind of lost track of him a few years ago. I'm not too up to date on him. I know that he does kind of a diverse bunch of art though.
Yeah. Like, and I dig him for trying it, but like, I just don't feel like the sound is like there yet. Whereas a group like Horror of 1999, you could tell, I think that's like the life they actually live. Like they live in their van with beer cans and like blunt wrappers, like just strewn about, and like use yoga mats for sleeping bags and toilets.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to check these guys out. I was trying to Google them and my internet's being slow. But I will check that out.
Yeah, definitely check them out. And I'll check out like Soul Glow, because like I definitely need to expand my playlist. And I've been listening to like a lot of South African punk and metal. Like there's this one group. Yeah, this one group called Roach Clip. It's like my favorite shit. Like Roach Clip, they go so hard. And Radkey. That's another group that I'm listening to. Roach Clip
Radkey?
And Radkey, yeah. Radkey. Those two. Like Radkey's like a real young group, and I believe like Roach Clip is like on the younger side, but like they've been around for a while too.
Oh, cool. All right. Yeah. I got them pulled up to listen to later.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. I'm always looking to branch out. You know, I'm in my 40s, I'm a dad, I'm like an armchair punk now. I'm not at all. No one's going to shows right now because of the pandemic, but you know, I get out to see some music like twice a year when there isn't a coronavirus going on.
Yeah, I know. Like whenever that happens.
Yeah.
So speaking of being an adult, I am in my 40s, my early 40s as well. I don't have children, no, because I'm selfish. So like as you get older, it's often like a thing I concern myself with and I think about a lot. Like as you get older, become an adult, you got like real life, a wife and kids. How do you find balance and center yourself in a creative practice that doesn't necessarily fit a 9-to-5 world?
Yeah. So I was 9-to-5-ing, working in marketing, like writing ads, up until a little over a year ago. And it was kind of, my kid is 5 years old. So it was kind of catch as catch can. Like I'd be just trying to get a little bit of my own work done every day, you know, when my kid was asleep or he's napping during the day or after he goes to bed, or if I can wake up really early and write without waking him up. Just a little something so I wouldn't lose that sense of myself as a creative person. So it makes me feel kind of centered. If I don't work on that, I feel anxious. I feel stressed out. I feel like I can't focus. I feel like I need to be really, really engaged with something on that level, or I have a difficult time working in the rest of the world. So it was a big struggle. I got laid off about a year and a half ago. And it hurt, but I think it needed to happen, and it precipitated a career change. So I've been freelance writing and it's going okay. And Black Card came out about a year ago, and that kind of opened some doors for me professionally. So I'm doing work that kind of hits a little bit closer to my soul along with my wallet for once. You know, those two things don't feel separate, which is its own version of stress. But I'll tell you what, man, it's I'm so glad I'm not having to write ads or whatever right now.
Yeah.
I think it would be really hard to do that.
Yeah. I feel it. Cause let's like, I do client work still, as far as like graphic art and design goes. And like, I do a lot of image consulting work. But it's all freelance. I like, I run my own company, and, how I run it is we're just a network of freelancers. So it's just like, if I need somebody to do web design, I can contact one of the people in my network and say like, okay, here's the project. And I just project manage everything. But I couldn't have it any other way. Like, I can't work in an office. I tried it. It just doesn't work out. I feel stifled. I feel like somebody has their boot in my neck all the time. And like, I never felt as creative in an office as I do when I'm just allowed to like walk in my yard or just like go on a hike or do something, like just like reconnect with being alone and like having nothing around me but birds chirping or crickets or just like leaves rustling.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you're in an office and you're kind of, you have a front up at all times. You're kind of performing. You're there being an employee, and it's not productive. No. You know, I was thinking about that in some of these office jobs. I mean, you know, you doing like 90 minutes to 3 hours worth of work in a day is good. I think like that means you probably got all your stuff done. Maybe that's why I was the guy that got laid off if I was only working for a couple hours a day, but it seems like that's all that really gets done. Otherwise you're kind of changing gears, shuffling the meetings and things. And it's just not the best use of time. I'm wondering, like, as this went, if this pandemic ever ends, you know, how that will change the way that people, their relationships are being present at work.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And that's, I feel like that's really like on a lot of people's minds now, especially people who've never had to do anything like this before. Cause like, I've pretty much been like a home office or work remotely person my entire life. Like, I've never had to hold down an office position for like a terribly long time. Thank the universe for that. So like, this is going to be a, like a brave new world for a lot of people. And I don't think a lot of people are prepared for this. And I fear for them. I worry about them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think some people it comes easier to than others, both being in an office and being out of an office. Yeah. Yeah. And being back to being a parent, it kind of makes the other bullshit melt away. It makes it clear, like, what is important. You know, I told myself I could have, when I had a kid, when I had a job, I was like, I can have one thing. I could either, you know, I wanted to run a marathon and I wanted to play some music and I wanted to write a book. I was like, I can't do all those things. I can have one. So I'm going to work on books. I mean, I also haven't, you know, been to a bar that I didn't feel like going to for about 6 years now. So it kind of made me choosier about what I do. I just do the stuff I really want to do. So my enjoyment is better, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, if I can stay awake past 9.
Right. Exactly. I feel like it's more like quality as opposed to like quantity. Like, going out all the time, it gets to be obnoxious and like, it's just a bunch of bullshit. Where it's just like, when you can, like you said, like when you can choose, it's like, you know what? No, I'm going to go to that bar because they serve Japanese whiskey and I love Japanese whiskey. Which is true.
Yeah.
I love Japanese whiskey. So I only go to that one bar because they have Japanese whiskey and they play like weird, like synth jazz. And I can just vibe out there as opposed to going to the obnoxious like bro bar that everybody's just drinking Budweiser at. Which, no offense to people who drink Budweiser, it's a fine beer, but it tends to attract a certain crowd that I don't want to be around.
Yeah. At this point, I want to get a seat and my drink should come in a real glass and I shouldn't have to go hoarse trying to shout over the music.
Right. So
I would like that music to be some synth jazz. There's a bar here called The Gold Line that some of the people from, I forget what Mad Lib's record label is, if it's Fat Beats or if it's another one, but they open it and they have Japanese whiskey and that's like on my list. I don't drink very often, but at some point when it's okay to leave the house, I'm going to go up there. Yeah. It sounds like we like similar places.
Yeah. Yamazaki is like by far the best whiskey. Yamazaki, with the hint of honey in it, sounds so smooth.
I haven't tried that. So smooth. Yeah, that sounds very smooth.
Yeah, it's like I mean, like when last time I had it, it was like $23 a glass, and it's worth every single dollar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe every single dollar. It's quality over quantity. I think that's aging. Yeah.
And I'm drinking now. It's just like, this is my summer of soju. So I'm drinking a lot of like Korean alcohol.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
It goes like, again, that goes down super smooth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That stuff's dangerous.
Yeah, it is. That's a whole, it is quite dangerous. So I feel like, because I dabble in writing. I am nowhere near like a writer, but I dabble in it. I went to school for it because I wanted to write screenplays originally, and that didn't work out. So I transitioned into graphics, which is just another expression of my creativity. And I still use cinematic techniques with that. But I feel like that there's wanting to do the thing, and that is different from actually doing the thing or becoming a thing-er. What was the initial ping moment that made you decide, I'm going to be a writer / novelist?
I always liked writing. My mother is a librarian, and so she always was very encouraging with books. And I showed aptitude for reading and writing in school pretty quickly. I'm also one of those people where if I'm interested in it, I'm all the way in. But if I'm not interested, I have a really hard time doing it. So I was like the getting an A in English and C's and B minuses and everything else type of student. But my undergrad degree was in English at VCU in Richmond. And then I knew that I eventually wanted to go to grad school, and, you know, I wanted to write books. I wanted to teach writing. But I wanted to live my life a little bit more. So I got to a point, I was maybe like 28. I was living in New York. I was doing like copy editing and proofreading and a little bit of copywriting work. I was actually working for one of Avon's brands, like the makeup company, if you could imagine. I was helping make Avon catalogs. I learned a lot about blush. But, you know, and I was in my late 20s, like, okay, this is the best job I've ever had. And this is not what I want to do with my life, you know, and this isn't going to get better on its own. So I think it's time for me to start looking at going to school before I get much older. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the thing that kicked it off, being like, I'm staring down 30 and helping, you know, I'm editing the names of different eyeliners. This isn't quite where I want to be. You know, I kind of felt like I didn't want to feel like the world was passing me by and like I was just killing time when I could be spending it well. You know, I make a lot of jokes about how I spent a good couple of years there, like getting drunk, watching CSI Miami on the couch every evening. It's a good show, but I wanted to do a little bit more with myself. You know, and it's weird to be in New York City where everyone's, you know, the city's always going. Everyone's always doing something. And I needed that kind of kick in the ass. But, you know, I was trying to get into that stream. So I applied for MFA programs and got into school. And that's what kind of brought me in, because I was going into debt, taking a big risk to do this thing. So it felt pretty do or die. I lost a lot of sleep over it.
Yeah.
But it worked out. I'm doing what I want to do. I'm happy. Yeah.
That's dope. And a lot of people can't say it. Say that, like, they're doing something that makes them happy, like, regardless of whether it's an immediate financial boon or not. It's just like, if you dedicate yourself to something that you love doing, or that you in the very least really like doing, then, like, I feel like that's a larger reward than, say, working at Avon, getting a fat paycheck, and then hating yourself like every day.
Yeah, it's weird. Every now and then I kind of, you know, you take stock of how you feel, your emotions, and just how you're kind of living in your body and in your mind. And I'm like, there's something missing. I feel different. I feel lighter. And it's like, I don't have a certain sense of dread that I had before when I was forcing myself to do work that I wasn't that invested in for money. So I feel immensely lucky, and I'm trying to enjoy every minute of it, because I have a feeling it's not ever going to get better than this. You know, I'll eventually have to do something else also.
Right. There's always that. Back of the head, it's just like, all right, I guess got to get ready for just in case.
Yeah, mentally prepare for the bullshit.
Yeah. So, speaking of shit, when was your oh shit, I'm a writer moment?
Yeah, that's hard. Right, there's the kind of when am I okay with calling myself a writer, and also when am I okay with calling myself an author? I think writing wise, I remember one time it was like 2011, and I had published a couple short stories, and I was talking to a friend about something. I forget what it was. And I was kind of having a couple feelings about it. And I remember being like, as this is how I feel. But as a writer, this is what I'm thinking. And then I kind of paused and was like, I feel like I just sounded like a dick when I said that. And he was like, you kind of sounded like a dick. I was like, okay, I'm going to put that on ice for a while. But maybe 2 years later or a year or two later, my first novel, Zero Fade, was getting ready to get published. And I was talking to one of my professor's husbands. He was kind of like, yeah, I wrote this book. He's like, you mean you are the author of this book, because you are an author now. You got to own it, man. And so I did. you know, coming from that punk rock background, it's very like, you got to be humble. Right. You can't like self-promote too much. You got to kind of shoot yourself in the foot. And I'm still kind of coming from that place a lot of the time.
Right. Yeah. It's so hard. Cause like, it's like, I don't want to seem egotistical when I say certain things, but it's just like claiming ownership of like something that you created is sometimes like one of the most difficult things. It's like even more difficult than making the thing that you've made. Like there's been projects I've worked in for like months and they turned out like really well. And I couldn't, when people ask what I do or what I did on the project, I couldn't tell them I was the artist. Like it was just like, I was part of the team that did this, but never it's just like, I am the artist, because it seems so weird to say like, I am an author, I am a screenwriter, I am an artist, especially when it's in a creative field.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I often wonder like, why is that? Why I could say like, if I worked at a bank, I can say I am a bank teller. If I was a fireman, I am a fireman. But saying I am an artist is like so difficult. I often wonder why.
I think part of it is like, if you're saying that to some white people, you kind of scared that they're going to think that you're bullshitting. You know, they're going to be like, right, sure. And you're also like the CEO of something, you know, and it's like, no, fuck you, really. I wrote a book. I am an author, you know.
Right.
And I also think that, you know, the drive to be a bank teller is different from the drive to be a creative person. And this probably transcends race. Like, you know, I think we're making stuff because we have something burning in the back of our brains, right? And part of it is like, we want to get this thing out in the world and we want a certain kind of validation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want this work to be recognized, but we're also really scared of what comes with that, because this person might not be feeling that thing. So we you're kind of making yourself vulnerable and opening yourself up to difficult criticism along with the praise, if you take that type of ownership, you know?
Right. And it's weird too, because like, since you you touched on it a little bit just then, it's just like, when I'm thinking about like that validation, it's often like, since I find myself in this particular field that I'm in, it's just like predominantly white, and it's odd that I'm often seeking validation from a white person or a white audience. And it's like, it's conflicting, like, because on the one hand, it's just like, fuck that. But at the same time, it's just like, well, shit, these are the people who, you know, are for the most part buying my shit or the most part hiring me to do this work. So it's just like, while I don't necessarily consider myself a seeker of validation from white people or whiteness, at the same time, it's just like whiteness is kind of integral to me eating.
Yeah. You can seek the paycheck validation.
Yeah.
No, I've been thinking about that with writing as well. You know, there's the kind of the places where you can publish and the things that you can do as an author that indicate success. Those are the markers of success. And like a lot of those things are a lot of it is like a very white space, a very like upper class, you know, financially privileged space, and a very New York centric thing.
Mm.
And I'm not like any of those three things. So, you know, I can feel shut out from that. And I'm wondering like, if this is, it's kind of that stress of being like, if this is what success is supposed to look like, I don't think I'll ever achieve success. Like I need to rethink what success means and kind of do it on my own terms, or find it on some other terms as well. You know, and I've been thinking about that, just trying to do my work and put my energy in places that I believe in or in things that I love. Mm. Like I've been writing for a punk rock magazine called Razor Cake for about 14 or 15 years. And I love doing that. And I read Razor Cake. Mm. I don't necessarily read some of these prestigious publications that as an author with a career, I want to be in for my career.
Right. You
know? Yeah. Shout out to Razor Cake.
Shout out to Razor Cake. So what we'll do now is we'll just take a little break and be right back. Welcome back, everybody. We're still here with Chris. So I've often wondered, as an avid reader, like I love reading. I've loved reading since I was a kid. My mom used to treat me to the library whenever I did well on like a test or like did something good, like all my chores. It's also known as being a huge nerd. I would bring home like stacks of like 12 books. So I've often wondered though, like what is a quote unquote black book, or what makes a story black? There seems to be like a divide of, let's say fiction, for example, black fiction versus fiction written by a black person. So what do these concepts mean to you?
Black fiction is anything written, or is black fiction is fiction written by a black author? And a black story is a story that features black characters. It's about black people. And ideally that is also written by a black author. So I think that's the line. I think when you say black fiction, do you mean like kind of the more like mass market type of paperbacks? What do you mean?
Like the stereotypical black fiction, or the fiction that the stories that people almost expect a black person to write. So that, that'd be like a slave narrative, or like something in the hood, like, you know, anything in the hood where the first person, like where the protagonist's name is usually a stereotypical like downtrodden black woman, or this like hood hero named Leroy, you know.
You know, and you have the boxes you have to check. There's got to be, someone's got to die by gun violence. There's got to be some police brutality in there. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, on the other hand, you have work like Octavia Butler. Work like Octavia Butler, which like kind of trend, like it is very much, at least for me, it is very much like a black work of fiction. And also at the same time can transcend that to something like even more glorious. And I, because like at least in when I'm dealing with like art, whether it be like painting or digital art that I produce, like I find that like a lot of my stuff, it's not quote unquote black. At least I've been told it's not black. This is both by black people and by non-black people, because none of my subject, like they, it's not something that's expected of me. A lot of it is just like glitchy kind of CRT, like collagey illustrations with lots of skulls and like death metal influences, like, cause that's the shit that I like. And my, the subject is mostly about mental health, like depression, anxiety, and dealing with that. And I put it out. I mean, obviously I'm black, but I wouldn't be considered like a quote unquote black artist. I am an artist that is black, but I'm not a quote unquote black artist. So I wondered like if in the writing field, like it was the same way. Cause like, there are books like I described before, like that hood, the hood, very hood centric black black stories versus things that kind of transcend all of that.
Yeah, I think that can be the case in the literary spaces, but it's been changing. I think that there is, I read a lot of black fiction almost exclusively. Read black authors, and I think that, you know, there's so many books out there, and the more I read, the more I understand is out there. And there's such a breadth of experiences that are being shared. It isn't all either like a slave story or, you know, Boys in the Hood, but on paper. You know, there's like bougie black stories that are being told really well. There's kind of weird, strange Octavia Butler type of black stories that are being told. There's, you know, new ways of messing with mixed race narratives, which is interesting to me. There's a lot of different stuff, but there still are people out there that are like, well, I need my black fiction to be about slaves or whatever, you know, and that is still a thing. And, you know, we need another black movie about slaves, and another TV show, you know. It's interesting that like some people don't want to act like slavery didn't really happen or like it was so long ago, but it wasn't. And sometimes it's also like that's like the only stories that are really accepted about us. Like what is being perpetuated here? Because, you know, white people need to be reminded of slavery, but they also need to know that that's not all we are.
Right.
Yeah.
And just finding like that dichotomy of just like, you know, there are more than just like slave stories, but also it's just like, bitch, don't forget slavery. Like, it's been there.
Yeah. It's funny. Yeah. It's kind of fun to like put white people in that, like, either way you lose type of situation. this is kind of how it feels. So now you have to deal with that. Mm. You know, you need to accept the slavery story, but don't expect the slavery story.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
I like that.
But you know, I don't know. New black fiction. Britt Bennett's most recent book is called The Vanishing Half. And that's like, it's partially a passing narrative. It's about these two light-skinned sisters, and one of them passes for white. Mm. There's a lot of stuff about colorism in there, and about being a black person and living around like wealthy white people. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Rion Amilcar Scott writes short stories all set in this fictional town called Cross River, Maryland, which I believe was like the site of a successful slave uprising. So it's like a black town and kind of in the DMV, the DC area. And a lot of that stuff has kind of a supernatural twist, and it's kind of elliptical and weird. But it still has, you know, black signifiers. Like there's a story about a barber losing his touch that kind of takes on these bigger meanings in one of his books. And I think his first one, which is called Resurrections. Dan Zissena wrote this book called New People, which touches on like the Jonestown cults and black bohemians and Fort Greene, Brooklyn in the 90s, and some of the ironies of like mixed race identity. It's got this kind of white passing narrator that grew up culturally black, and her fiance is also mixed, but he looks blacker, but he pretty much grew up around white people. So she's like, looks like she's white, but she's teaching this black looking dude how to be black in the story. So, you know, there's room for a lot of different stuff out there. And then, you know, read Kindred by Octavia Butler, which is such a good slavery story because it makes it, you know, you take a character from the relatively current day. The book is set in the 1970s, and she goes back to slavery. And so you see somebody from now, basically, being confronted with the actual realities of slavery. And it makes it pretty hard to deny just how fucked up it was, you know?
Yeah.
It humanizes it.
Yeah. So I was like, I wondered, like, the new movie with Janelle Monáe, Antebellum. Like, I've only seen the trailer, but it kind of feels like that's something, like, similar.
Yeah. I think it's like inspired by Kindred. They're hopping to the fact that they pretty much took the idea, but they made some kind of a leap. Yeah. I don't know quite what the deal is with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering.
I was intrigued, but because it did seem like rather like it was biting, but it was just like, it seems like it might be a different story. Almost like I don't know if you're into Doctor Who, but.
Not really. No.
Okay. So there are these alien creatures that look like statues. So when you look at them, they're perfectly still, like they don't move. They look like stone statues or gargoyles. But as soon as you turn your back, that's the only time that they can move. So when you look at them, they're out of phase with reality. But as soon as you turn your head, they're back in phase with reality. And what they do is when they attack, they don't kill you. They just send you back like 50 years or 100 years or like 400 years. It's completely random. Like how I believe it's completely random how far back they send you. And they're one of the most feared things because like there's all these like creatures and things out there that go bump in the night that could kill you. But these are the scariest things because like they don't move when you look at them. But as soon as you turn your back, you're like you exist 500 years ago.
Wow.
So
yeah, wow. That's really creative. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, it's not that I don't like Doctor Who. It's just that I've never really checked it out. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I got into it heavy for a while. And then like they switched to one of the doctors and I just lost interest because they switched doctors like every so often. And I just like lost interest because I didn't like that doctor and I never got back into it because I'm a hating ass hater.
Sure.
But like, like there's definitely some interesting stories in like Doctor Who that was just that made me think and kind of like influenced or like at least like in like I found it to be very innovative.
Yeah.
So speaking of like Doctor Who, which is a weird series, what in your opinion, what makes a story or an artist or an author weird?
I think that ideally, I think if you're an artist, if you're a storyteller, you're going to be weird no matter what. because I think weirdness is deviating from the mainstream. And I think that to be a good artist or a good creative person, you need to be an observer and you need to have some distance from the stuff that you're writing about. Right. So if you're fully meshing with day-to-day life, you're probably not going to have a whole lot of perspective. So I think that it's kind of just in, I think any sort of creative person is inherently weird. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, almost have to be. And it's also like a survival tactic. In my opinion, it's almost like a survival tactic because like one of the reasons I got into art was because I was getting like bullied and I used creativity as currency and I started drawing for the bullies. Like I would draw superheroes and everything for the bullies so that they would think I was cool. And so they started they didn't fuck with me as much until the point where they stopped fucking with me because I was like drawing like them as superheroes and just like giving them art for free. Yeah. Wow. This was like in grade school. So like once I figured that out, I was just like, oh shit, there's something to art. And little did I know back then, like I was like, oh yeah, this is the art business. Because you're going to be, this is a creative business because you're going to be dealing with bullies like, and you just have to appease them with like, giving them this creative shit that they like.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Wow. Yeah, that's a survival tactic.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow, yeah.
So what, like, could you describe, just for the layperson or the person that just would have no idea, could you describe the, like, what is it that, what do you think Black creatives have to go through that their white counterparts don't have to deal with, especially when it comes to creative, like weird speculative fiction?
I mean, I think it's still kind of expectations of the things that we could or couldn't write about.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think what else. Sorry for the dead air.
No, it's all right. It's thinking. This was kind of like a thing that, again, you said something and it made me think of something else. And so I just had to.
Well, you know what? I got something for you. This is something I'm kind of struggling with in my own work right now. I'm working on a project that is a little bit more speculative. It's in a made up world and it's black characters. But you know, it isn't the book is about kind of family dynamics and power dynamics, within this family. And I'm talking about this like it's really a living thing, but I've just been working on it for a couple months. And for all I know, I'm jinxing myself by telling too much. But since I'm writing in this world that isn't like a white supremacist world, the fact that they're black is kind of secondary. So it's just like if I get into a character description, it's like, yeah, so his hair is a little tighter than mine. His skin is a little darker than mine. Or, you know, this character is darker or lighter than the other. You know, this one's, you know, browner. But beyond that, it isn't a lot of the kind of touchstones of oppression that you might find in other stories. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to write this kind of, in some ways, utopian black world and show the ways that power can corrupt anybody who has it. Mm-hmm. But I am scared that if I finish this thing and this world stays roughly this weird that I'm writing, that the characters won't be accepted as black, especially by business people, that they're going to put some Caucasians on the cover of the book. Because you hear about those things happening. I've heard some kind of horror stories. There was a controversy a few years ago where like the foreign rights to a book by a black author would get sold and they put like a picture of a white person on the cover. Yeah. And it's like, well, this isn't going to sell in Denmark if it's got a black person on the cover. They need other blondes on there, you know?
Right.
Right. And, you know, so I'm wondering, you know, I'm wondering if that's something that I'd have to deal with or, you know, ways to share this type of, blackness that feel real and feel authentic when some of the oppression has been removed, you know? Yeah, because I know that we are way more than just that. So I'm still finding my way into this story.
Yeah. I feel like it's always something, especially like when you're in a creative field, that you're constantly trying to find your way or just like navigate through your own creativity, your own bullshit, and then like the bullshit of everything around you, like the people that you have to deal with in order to get your stuff out there in front of the eyes and or the ears of like, you know, the people you want it to be in front of. And like a lot of people don't know about the compromises and the business behind like being a creative, especially like being like someone that's a like digital artist like myself or an author like you.
Yeah. Yeah. Luckily, you know, I mean, I'm not making a lot of compromises as an author. I'm kind of just making a leap of faith and trying to write a book and hoping that somebody wants to sell it. Mm-hmm. But I'm also, you know, I'm not calculating the book in a way where I hope that it will appeal to, you know, to the people with the checkbooks. I'm just trying to write a good book.
Right.
You know, it was different in, you know, in like writing ads or doing marketing work. It's a little bit different because the relationship to the, my relationship to the work that I was doing right. wasn't as personal, you know? So it's kind of trying to appeal to people that I might not have a whole lot in common with. Mm. Trying to find that common ground or and not seem like I'm pandering or seem like I'm seem like I'm completely off base when I'm trying to, like, you know, sell some shoes to some white college students or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Selling shoes to white college students using black imagery.
Right. Yeah. Or just like, yeah, just like the things that you, that I ended up forcing myself to not think too hard about because I go crazy just so I could get that check. Like I was working at the sort of, I don't want to be naming names, but a few years ago I was working at like a kind of progressive startup-y company. Mm. And it was really, really white. And they did some cringy, culturally appropriative shit around race and like lots of pictures of like the white CEO with a bunch of brown kids and things like that. Mm. And, you know, it just made my blood curdle. But I needed a check and I couldn't get out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. It's just the shit you do for a check. It's so wild.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I mean, because we live in like a, you know, it sounds cliche now, but like a patriarchal capitalist society, it's just like kind of, when you, like, a lot of people, unfortunately, they don't have the luxury of saying, fuck you, I'm going to do what I want and creating the thing that they want to create.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I can't tell if it's just because I've been around a little longer and it's kind of impossible to deny a lot of this stuff or like the national conversation and politics are such that just more people are getting their eyes open to these things. I hope it's column B. I hope it's not just me, you know, gradually just getting madder and madder as I age.
Right.
Yeah.
Just because it's like cantankerous curmudgeon. I mean, yeah. I'm basically there. It's just like two or three more days before it's just like, this is it. That's it. Fuck it.
Yeah.
So punk rock.
Yeah.
While like, it is like, it is, there are people of color in punk rock, and like I hung out, like when I was going to high school, it was like two or three kids, like there was maybe like there was like one other black kid and two, like one was Israeli and then one was from, like, I believe he was Afghani, but like wow. We were all into like metal and like punk rock music. I mean, we listened, like, that's how I was introduced to like Metallica, but also Rage Against the Machine and like all these other bands. But we were still considered the weirdos. And I would say, especially me, because I was like the darker of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you throw on top of that, I played Dungeons and Dragons. Like I did I ran the gamut of like weird nerd shit. Uh-huh. Anime, nice. Dungeons and Dragons, like you name it. I was involved. I am still involved. I won't front. I am still involved in it.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, absolutely not. So, like, personally, I feel it, and that's why I've created this podcast, because I wanted to show, like, that there is nothing wrong with that. Like, you know, just, like, do you, be as creative as you want to be, you know, and feel free to express yourself. But still, there are limitations that we place on ourselves, whether it's the individual or the community, the society, the environment, etc. So it goes from mm-hmm. within to without. What can we do, in your opinion, and this is like a wild, broad statement, I understand, but what can we do as black creatives to push past, or no, as a black community, to push past this white people shit banner? Because punk rock, white people shit, like right. Norwegian death metal, while it is made by white people, I mean, me listening to it in my car while I'm driving, that's white people shit. Like,
sure. I don't know. I think it's changing. I think the internet is changing. I think that a lot of stuff, just information has kind of been democratized in a way where you can be a black kid who's finding weird heavy metal music on the internet. Mm-hmm. And you can find other black kids who like weird heavy metal music online who are, you know, who are elsewhere. You can find the kid who is the quote unquote black friend and talk about that experience. So I think it is starting to change, you know? I think that there's more room in the Black identity is broadening, that there's more room for those kind of non-mainstream Black experiences and likes. But it's also, you know, I think it's defensive calling something some white shit. I mean, or, you know, wanting to fit in with other Black people because, you know, we're getting it from all directions, and we need to stick together. We need to work together. And we need to, you know, make sure that we have some common ground. And hopefully it isn't superficial stuff, like if you're listening to At the Gates or if you're listening to Freddie Jackson. I'm getting all my decades going here, but...
Yes. Run them.
Yeah. You know, and hopefully we can get past that kind of superficial stuff, and it is more about, you know, getting together on some, you know, more big tent political stuff. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking. That's what I hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, I think that some of the like rebellious shit, like punk rock, it is kind of privileged, you know? Mm-hmm. You got to have been entrenched in something for a lot of times, like the punk perspective is privileged. It's like, I'm entrenched in this stuff and like the suburbs suck. And like,
right.
If you're Black, there's less of a chance that you've been in the suburbs for long enough to get sick of it, you know?
Absolutely.
But so, I mean, that's something I like about rebellious Black music, be it hip hop or punk rock, is that it isn't always that type of like privileged suburban ennui. It's, you know, punk music, but it's speaking on stuff that more Black people are dealing with now than just like, I hate the supermarket or whatever.
I hate Whole Foods. Fuck Whole Foods. Yeah. I mean, if I came out with a song saying fuck Whole Foods, I would be very appreciative of that.
Yeah, you can make a whole album on that topic.
So there's this term, the culture. Especially within like Black circles.
Sure.
So it's something that like I struggle with because I'm just like, well, what the fuck is the culture? Mm-hmm. Like, am I a part of the culture even though I don't participate in many of the activities of the culture? And so I'd like to know your thoughts because like as somebody who like, you know, constantly struggles like in and out and like has been like picked on and shit because I was like into different things. Like, what do you like? How would you define the culture? And do you think that like having these varied interests is in opposition of the culture, or is it a kind of spectral part of the culture?
Yeah. So Blackheart is the main character's development. He's kind of, he goes at the beginning, you know that Zen saying that's like, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Yeah.
This kind of central question at the beginning is like, if I'm the only Black person there, then how do I know if what I did was Black?
Mm-hmm, right.
Is this the Black way to do whatever I'm doing? I will never know. And by the end, he's kind of like, well, if I'm a Black person and I'm doing this thing, then I'm doing it the Black way.
Right.
So I think that whatever a Black person is doing is part of the culture, unless they're, you know, Candace Owens or something. That's not part of the culture. Yeah, if you're working slightly outside of Blackness, that's one thing. But if you're working against Blackness, then that's definitely not for the culture. That's against the culture.
Yeah.
So outside of Black culture would be like listening to some heavy metal music. Working against the culture would be being a far right wing troll on the internet. You know, that's against the culture for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also like often wonder, should we just say like, fuck it? Like Candace Owens is lost. Or is it just like, do we have to also like, accept people like Candace Owens and say like, look, well, she is Black. She might do some real anti-Black shit, but like she is a Black woman. So like we have to figure out a way, or does that even like fall on our shoulders? Should we just say like, well, fuck it. She's also a dumbass human being. So.
Yeah. You know, I know I was joking about Kanye being dead before, and it's like a similar question. I think that you should not feel the pressure just to like some bad shit or some mediocre shit just because it's some Black shit. And that do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm trying to think where to go, because this can go. I have a lot of thoughts to say, and I'm trying to organize them. Just because Candace Owens is Black, you know, being a far right wing troll, it's more hurtful to us because if we see somebody who we feel like we have some stuff in common with, you know, have some collective memory with here, and she's doing this, so it really hurts, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we shouldn't accept that just because she's Black. It's kind of like that idea of like I need to, you know, support every like mediocre, uninteresting, boring looking piece of black media just because it's black media. And I need to like make a case to the white people who are cutting the checks for it that there is a financial case to be made for this. Like, I'm not going to just watch this movie to like prove a point to some white person with a checkbook. You know what I mean? I know that, I know that like a boring movie is a way different thing from, you know, sharing white supremacy on the internet. But I think it's a similar thing where, you know, just because it's black doesn't mean we have to like it.
Right. If shit is white, shit is white, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that, you know, you will just, that kind of lowered expectations of like, well, I guess I'm going to watch this dumb movie just because it's the black thing. Like, that's deadening, you know, that'll, that'll lower your bar and no.
It's because like I've heard these conversations happen before, and like I've been privy to some of these conversations and participated in some of these conversations. It's just like, well, black, if we stop watching bad black shit, like, you know, if we stop reading bad black shit, well, then that's going to take money away from potentially some good black shit in an inadvertent way, because then nobody's going to want to fund any black shit. And it's we can't be beholden to some like white purse holder that's going to say like, this is the black shit that sells, so that is the black shit I will fund. Like,
Exactly.
On the one, white. Thank you. I'm very fluent in Caucasian. So it's like we have to figure out a way like to make our own economy, our own creative economy. But at the same time, like we live in America, so you know, it's just like it's going to be a constant struggle, and I feel like as a black, as black people, we know how struggle goes.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah,
cool. So I could talk with you forever about this type of shit, and I'm loving this conversation. But alas, we only have a limited time on this earth. So I want to give you the rest of this time to plug whatever you want to plug, get promote whatever you want to promote, and tell the people what you got going on.
Sure, sure. So the main thing I'm cooking with right now is Black Card, the novel. Catapult published it about a year ago. It just came out on paperback. It was one of NPR's best books of the year. And they called it, they said it strikes a superb balance between levity and heaviness. And Terry crafts an enormously fun read about a decidedly less than fun topic. And that topic is a mixed race black person on a serious mission to win back his black card. He sings a hip hop song at a karaoke night at a country bar. He tries to eat sushi with a black coworker and fails miserably. And eventually he also gets racially profiled, and that kind of changes the way things look for him. I hope I'm not spoiling too much. If you want to read more, you can find the book at your library or at your local independent and preferably black-owned bookstore. Black Card. Yeah, cool. Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, no problem. And then if you have any social media that you want to...
Twitter, it's pretty much either me promoting book stuff or making jokes about my five-year-old. It's just Chris L. Terry, middle initial L, to differentiate me from the NFL dude with the coke charge. And same thing on Instagram, Chris L. Terry, which has kind of more of a variety of stuff.
All right, cool. So
find me out there.
Cool. I have Black Card. I'm on bookshop.org, and Black Card is in my cart, so that as soon as we stop talking, I will place that order. I've been waiting for a chunk of change to order it to come, and I finally got my Trump check, so I'm going to use some of my money that Trump has decided to graciously give me back to buy Black Card.
I got one of those stimulus things back in April, I think, and pretty much spent it all on stuff that I thought would piss off Republicans. When I was done paying bills. Planned Parenthood got some money, all sorts of black shit. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I hope this pisses off one Republican at least by buying your book. All right. So last question before we go.
Sure.
What is black?
Black is whatever black people do.
Cool. Great talking to you, Chris.
You too, Jason.
Good luck with your future endeavors. No problem. Thanks for being on the podcast. Loved having you. And we'll let you know whatever's coming up in the future.
Thank you. This has been great.
Cool. Thanks, man.
Thank you. All right.
What is Black podcast, a McCoy creative project. For more information and bullet notes that provide deeper context, check out the field notes on whatisblackpodcast.com. Your support is always much appreciated. So if you want to toss us a few dollars to keep this going, visit ko-fi.com/whatisblackpodcast. That's Ko-fi spelled ko-fi.com/whatisblackpodcast. If you don't have the loot, that's cool. Support us by sharing this with your people, following us on Spotify, or rating us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. If you drop us 5 stars, we might just shout you out and answer your general questions on Black artness. If you need to contact us, hit up whatisblackpod@gmail.com or on Instagram at whatisblackpodcast. And to quote Bernadine in full righteous anger, you're the motherfucking improper influence. Get your shit and get out. Peace.